As a preface to my remarks today, I'd like to tell you of my love for England for a number of reasons. First of all, on both sides of my family, for the generations that we have about up to 10 and 12, all are in England on my mother's and father's side. On Sister Hale's side, it's a McIntyre in Scotland and Crandall of England, and then, of course, Sweden and Germany. And she wanted me to remind everyone today that there were others who made a contribution because my talk is heavily weighted towards England. I also wanted to let you know in my own home the pleasure of hearing an accent from Manchester, England in the prayer, and understand that my two boys went to school in the Wimbledon Common Preparatory School, commonly called the Squirrels, which was a preparatory school for King's College, of which they look back on with memories. And the fact that our family has lived in England, both as a mission president and in business, we've lived there 5 years. I think that I also had the fond memories of my mother and father serving a mission there, and then after their mission, staying with us when we lived in Wimbledon. So for these years, a great love of England certainly is part of our life. This celebration of the 150 years of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the British Isles does provide an opportunity to recognize the contribution of the English to the laying of the foundation of the restoration of the gospel in the last days and the divine intervention in the history of England. From that damp and foggy island in the Western Europe sprang a tenacity for truth and freedom whose influence has been felt around the world. The influence of the English is remarkable. The widespread use of the language has no precedent. Spanish and French, Arabic, Turkish, Latin, and Greek have served their terms as international languages, but none have come near to rivaling English. Today, 330 million people throughout the world speak it as a mother tongue, and we can add to this those who use English as a second language, and you approach 1 billion English speakers. It is often spoken in more countries than any other language of the world. It is the language of international shipping and air travel, of science and diplomacy. How has this happened? Partly through the power of Britain in the 19th century and America in the 20th century. But who are the English, and what is the source of their influence? The English language came before the country was called England. It was the name given to the dialect spoken of the Anglos and Saxons in Britain during the 5th century A.D. By the 11th century, the English were comprised of Celtics, Scandinavians, Norman, French elements also. Just like America during its history and today, this mixing of blood brought out unique qualities in its people. The English have always been devout Christians. It has not always rested comfortably with them. The conflicts between state and church hold center stage throughout English history, but appear to have been essential in the preparation of the independence of a free people. Christianity was introduced into Britain from the East in the 2nd century and was well established by the 4th century. In the beginning, Christianity flourished in Britain because of a fruitful partnership between the state and church. It was distinct and had no origins in Rome or associations with universal organization of papacy. An attempt by Augustine in 597 to bring the renegade English into the Catholic fold failed to have the desired effect. The debate on the Roman and English views of Christianity persisted across the centuries. The poet William Blake suggested divine origins for the unique faith developed in England. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountain green? And was the Holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pasture seen? We do not know. All we do know is that Christianity came before any invasion or influence from the outside, it appears. As the power of English grew, so did the stature of the English kings who nurtured and enriched it. Not surprising, therefore, that the legend of King Arthur, about 539, as a defender of Christian virtue, came from this period, and King Richard, in 1189, devoted his reign to the fighting of the Crusades. But human nature being what it is, The power invested in one man, the king, was sooner or later bound to cause conflict between church and state. The first significant signs came in the reign of Henry II, about 1153. In a struggle to exercise control of the church, Henry and Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, had Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, killed. Henry's son John had to face the bitter opposition from the church. This, combined with the hostility of his barons, brought him down. In June 1215 at Runnymede, John was forced to agree to the Magna Carta. There he signed away many of the monarch's powers. Achieving the delicate balance between church and state gave birth to the English Common Law, which is the bedrock of the British Constitution and also the basis of the American Constitution. Under this system, before sovereign and subject, both sovereign and subject, were bound by common law, and the liberties of Englishmen were determined, not by an enactment of state, but by an immemorial, slow-growing custom declared by juries of free men. It is interesting to note that the phrase time immemorial has its origins from this period in the 13th century. It was never to change. This was the beginning of a transformation in government. In 1265, Henry III had set up England's first parliament, one of the greatest gifts that Britain has given the world. Early in the 14th century, parliament developed into two houses, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Which form of government was adopted by the American founding fathers in what we now know as the Senate and the House of Representatives. Changes in the relationship between church and state continued at a moderate pace, fanned by reformers such as John Wycliffe, translation of the Bible into English, and William Tyndale, printing of the New Testament. Reading of the Bible by ordinary people became a reality and increased the protest for Reformation. When Henry VIII, in about 1520, broke his country's links with the Roman Catholic Church in order to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, the English Reformation was in full swing and abruptly altered the whole course of English history. In 1603, a new dynasty, the House of Stuart from Scotland, came to the throne. They misunderstood the beliefs of the English and underestimated the power of Parliament. Even the efforts of James I in 1604 to bring about national unity by having Puritan ministers and Anglican bishops make a new translation of the Bible backfired. The book was a great success and has endured as the most widely read Bible. It is the version used to this day by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and most Christian people. But its immediate impact was to encourage individual conscience. And that brought the Puritans into disfavor with King James. He told them unless they conformed to the Church of England, he would harry them out of the land. Finally, on September 16, 1620, the Mayflower sailed out of Plymouth with her 101 Puritan passengers, setting course for a new life in a new land. By 1649, the puritanical approach to Christianity had brought the Church and Parliament into direct opposition with the Crown. The result was civil war, the execution of Charles I, and a government, believe it or not, led by a Puritan, Oliver Cromwell. The very legal systems created by the medieval kings had signed the death warrant of an absolute monarchy. Although the monarchy was virtually restored with greatly limited powers, Parliament held the upper hand and democracy was born. The age of prosperity that followed expressed itself in the expanding British Empire. The Puritans who stayed at home were not all political pioneers. They also excelled in the arts. In poetry, John Milton, the sciences, Isaac Newton, engineering, James Watt. Their independence of thought and action gave birth to the Industrial Revolution. They prepared for that takeoff into the modern industrial world, which England was the first country to achieve. Just as George III's government was starting to encourage settlement in the empire, Britain lost its oldest settlement. The North American colonies broke away to declare their independence in 1776. Governing a worldwide empire without representation proved impossible. By the middle of the 20th century, all of Britain's possessions had achieved similar independence. The United States formally embodied the principles of the Declaration in its Constitution. This historic document was dedicated to the principles that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These words were written by Thomas Jefferson, a lawyer schooled in English law. The nation so founded was thus based on English concept of justice, law, and freedom, England's legacy to the New World. President Brigham Young said on one occasion, "The King of Great Britain might have been led to aggressive acts, for aught we know, to bring to pass the purposes of God, in thus establishing a new government upon a principle of greater freedom, a basis of self-government allowing the free exercise of religious worship. We now recognize the great and significant contribution of the English-speaking peoples of the world have made to the restoration of true Christianity to the world and to this earth. Motivated by their indomitable pursuit for truth and religious liberty, Joseph Smith, the architect of the Restoration, was born of British stock. On his paternal side, Robert and Mary Smith, Robert being an immigrant from England and America in 1638, and on his maternal side, John and Sarah Mack, John Mack being an immigrant from Scotland to America in 1680. If ever a man was in the right place at the right time with the right credentials, it was the prophet Joseph Smith. He had almost 1,000 years of searching in his background for truth. It lay in his heritage. Despite difficult financial times in Kirkland, through revelation, the prophet called the first missionaries to England. On being called to this assignment, Heber C. Kimball explained, "O Lord, I am a man of stammering tongue, and although unfit for such work, how can I go to preach in that land, which is so famed throughout Christendom for learning, knowledge, and piety, the nursery of religion, and to a people whose intelligence is proverbial?" This is from the life of Heber C. Kimball. On June 13th of 1837, the missionaries left their Kirkland homes and landed in Liverpool. On July 30th, 1837, thus commenced the restoration of the true gospel in the British Isles, and coincidentally, in the same year, starting the reign of Victoria when she came to the throne. In this year of 1987, we do celebrate 150 years of missionary labors among this great people. English convert immigrants became a part of a large infusion that gave Mormonism in America vitality and newly needed blood. By early 1841, at least 1,000 English LDS converts had moved to America. By 1846, when Nauvoo was evacuated, more than 3,000 English saints had settled there. By the turn of the century, approximately 50,000 English Mormons had emigrated to the United States. Prophecies had received literal fulfillment. The Lord had told Joseph Smith to look to England for help for the church's problems, and that help came and was so given by the Lord. Among those early stalwart converts from this land were such illustrious names as John Taylor, the third president of the church, George Q. Cannon, counselor in the First Presidency, John R. Winder, counselor in the First Presidency, George Teasdale, apostle, B.H. Roberts, a marvelous historian, member of the First Quorum of the 70. In England, the missionaries immediately found that many souls were ready and waiting for their message. England in the mid-19th century was at the zenith of the Industrial Revolution. Those most attracted by the missionary message were the casualties of social change, the poor, the unemployed, the illiterate. The conditions that prevailed among such people are well depicted in the novels of the time, such as Charles Dickens' Bleak House and David Copperfield. Dickens' vivid pictures of the life of the poor, huddled in airless factories, working dark and dreary mines, and living in city slums, are explanation enough of why many looked for relief in a new cause and in a new country. These people truly were the huddled masses that came to our shores. The traditional reasons that promoted immigration of non-LDS, of the Latter-day Saints, also promoted immigration of Mormon converts. Brigham Young and Willard Richards were certainly no strangers to poverty and privation. Brigham Young, so ill himself he could hardly walk, had left his sick wife and children in an Illinois shanty without proper food and medical attention to go on his mission to England in 1840. But some of the conditions in England were still a shock to him. In a joint letter written to Joseph Smith and the other members of the First Presidency, Elder Young and Elder Richards called conditions a mighty revolution in the affairs of common people. He continued, "The people have enough to keep from dying with hunger without taking much thought for the improvement of the mind. Many of the people cannot read, a great many cannot write. There are thousands and tens of thousands who cannot get one day's work in a month or 6 months, so they continue to labor 12 hours a day for almost nothing rather than to starve at once. Their miserable pittance is mostly oatmeal and water boiled together, and they would be quite content if they could get enough of that." That is a letter of Willard Richards and Brigham Young, 5th of September, 1840, written to the prophet who was living then in Nauvoo. But life for the new converts in the Promised Land was still difficult. Many of the early converts gathered at Nauvoo. Though the city eventually prospered, the first immigrants were faced with conditions as equally trying as those they left. One notable characteristic of Nauvooers was poverty. There was too little money available for investment, industry, or trade, so the economy was weak. Illinois, including Nauvoo, suffered the lingering after effects of the devastating National Depression of 1837. It was in the midst of this that the missionaries left for England. As Joseph Smith phrased it when inviting saints to gather in the city, quote, he said, "Let all that will come and partake of the poverty of Nauvoo freely." He had a sense of humor. Moving across the Atlantic, driven from one Mormon settlement to another, and then crossing the plains to the Great Basin, entailed enormous hardship. They had not expected ridicule and persecution. It seemed outrageous to those immigrant converts to be treated with prejudice in a country so proud of its declared religious tolerance. Many lost property, money, family, friends, and also testimony. The constant influx of enthusiastic new converts from England, arriving by the thousands, produced strength and encouragement to the church. But the English character has stoic qualities, developed through centuries of similar privations in temporal and spiritual affairs. The English Catholic suffered terrible persecution under Protestant kings, and the Protestants similarly suffered in like manner under Catholic monarchs. Converts to Mormonism were also tested by the refiner's fire, from which they emerged dedicated saints. Typical of the converts of that time were the Howells family of Wales. This, as you know, is the origins of present Mackay. William Howells, his wife Martha, then 4 months pregnant, their daughter Anne, their 7-year-old son William, and 2-year-old son Reese began their journey to Zion on March 4th, 1851. In spite of his longing to join the main body of the saints in Salt Lake, William Howells was saddened at the prospect of turning his back on his beloved Wales. He said in his journal, shuddering at the thought of having his deathbed surrounded by strangers and his grave in a foreign land. Despite these feelings, the Howells embarked on a voyage crossing the Atlantic. The Mormon immigrants, having baptized 21 fellow shipmates — by the way, these baptisms were performed on a platform thrown overboard and lowered into the sea. There was no reason to expect anything but good fortune in crossing the plains, as they anticipated. A few months later, however, William Howells' family was stricken with sickness. His frail constitution was not able to throw off the illness, and he died November 21st, 1851, at age 35, leaving his wife alone. Martha was left with the enormous task of getting herself, her babe in arms, and 3 other children a further 1,500 miles. She was forced to sell what few possessions she had to raise money for the journey. During the wagon trek toward Utah, Martha suffered another personal tragedy, the death of 9-year-old William. He had fallen asleep beneath a wagon wheel and did not hear anything when the wagon started up again. Martha was a true stalwart. In every sense of the word, she continued faithful to her conviction of the truthfulness of Mormonism. right up to her death, nearly 30 years later in 1879, after 10 years of a harsh existence in Utah. She made a one-year visit, returning back to Wales, where she received her share of her father's estate. Why did the Mormons arouse so much hostility? America was founded by devout Christians looking for a place to avoid persecution. Religious tolerance was incorporated into the Bill of Rights and later strengthened by its inclusion into indeed several state constitutions. Yet unlike other minority religions, they attracted animosity everywhere they went. At one point, at the height of their suffering in Kirkland, Ohio, they were persuaded to write their own declaration of belief regarding governments. I would hope that each of us would read the 134th section of the Doctrine and Covenants with this history we've related today in mind. In giving the background of this declaration, Joseph Smith wrote, "The reason for the article on government and law in general is explained in the fact that the Latter-day Saints have been accused by their bitter enemies, both in Missouri and in other places, as being opposed to law and order. They had been portrayed as setting up laws in conflict with the laws of the country. This bitterness went so far as an accusation of disloyalty was brought against them on one occasion in a Missouri court because they believed that at some future time the Lord would set up his own kingdom, which would supersede the government of the United States. And so believing that the time would come when such a kingdom would be established, they were disloyal to the United States. Every pretext that could be imagined," Joseph Smith continued, "against the saints to try to show them disloyal and rebellious against established government was brought into use." End quote. As we see that the Mormon experience is just a continuation of the age-old supposed conflict between kingdoms of the world and kingdoms of heaven, it is hard for man to differentiate the struggle to save his eternal soul from the struggle to survive in this mortal probation, this temporal world. The declaration of belief suggests there need be not any conflict. For it says in the fourth verse of the 134th section, "We believe that religion is instituted of God." In the first verse it says, "Governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man." In the ninth verse, "We do not believe it just to mingle religious influence with civil government." And continues in the next two verses, "The church therefore holds to the view of separation of church and state, no interference of church authority in political matters, and the freedom of the individual to pursue his political opinions. We do not believe," the 134th section continues, "we do not believe that human law has a right to interfere in prescribing rules of worship to bind the conscience of man, nor dictate terms for public or private devotion. However," it continues, "to the laws, all men we owe respect and deference, as without them, peace and harmony would be supplanted by anarchy and terror." I might add, as I worked in Eastern Europe, and I would give the 134th section to the ministers of religion, they were very impressed, not only with the 12th and 13th Articles of Faith, but with the Constitution of Mormonism, as outlined in the 134th section. From an eternal perspective, it must be realized that although it is not appropriate for the church to aspire for political supremacy, the saints are looking forward to the time when he, as it says in the 58th section, whose right it is to reign, even the Lord Jesus Christ, will reign and rule in the earth. In the meantime, they are, continuing in the 22nd verse of the 58th section, to be subject to the powers that be. Today, this declaration helps the church retain its presence in restricted political climates and gain an entry into countries for proselyting that might otherwise be denied. We as a church and people have come so far in our understanding, our freedoms, our religious liberty, and our standing in the world today, and it has been influenced by our English heritage. In this memorial year, we express our grateful thanks for that heritage. In concluding remarks, as part of giving my testimony of the significance of the missionary work in England and the faithful English immigrants who joined the church after reaching America, I'd like to give you a few stories from my personal family genealogical history and also Sister Hales's. On both my mother's and father's side, for all the generations which we've been able to trace, which some go back into the 1400s and 1300s. All of our families on my side go back to England, and 50% of her side. Here are some typical stories. I've divided them into three categories. The Pilgrim Pioneer Heritage is the first. John Crandall came to America from England in 1634 and helped to settle Rhode Island. Seven generations later, David Crandall was born. In 1833, he was the first of the Crandalls to join the church when two missionaries came to his home. The missionary enthusiasm for the gospel was so great that the Presbyterian and Baptist ministers gave the Latter-day Saint missionaries an opportunity to speak in their assemblies, resulting in a number of baptisms. In 1835, the David Crandall family moved to Kirkland. From there, they moved to Missouri in Pike County, Quincy, Illinois, La Harpe, and finally Council Bluffs, Iowa. In 1850, many of his children traveled on to Salt Lake City. On my mother's side, Joseph Holbrook's grandfather and two brothers came to England to the Plymouth Colony as pilgrims. I guess the point I'd like to make is that we can talk about the first missionaries, but really this migration and this emigration and this preparation started with the pilgrims. When you can see that on each of our sides, we go back to those pilgrim fathers. Joseph's father died when Joseph was only 7 years old. It was his father's dying wish that Joseph go to live with his grandfather in Massachusetts in order to have an opportunity to go to school. Joseph's grandfather taught him much. He was a moral man. He never indulged in any kind of vice, went to meetings on the Sabbath, believed in fulfillment of prophecy, and prayed with his family, asked blessings at meals, and did not allow profanity. It's a most interesting journal. This set the background for what was to happen in the life of Joseph Holbrook. This is from my maternal grandmother and grandfather. Joseph was ready to receive the gospel when the elders preached in a town near where Joseph was living. He asked them where he could get a copy of the Book of Mormon. They did not know. Joseph told the two young men who preached the gospel to him that he would walk a distance of 50 miles in order to obtain a copy if only they could direct him where it would be. They said they could not tell him where he could find a copy. It was interesting that Truman O'Angel's daughter whispered in his ear after the meeting, "I have a copy. I'll give it to you in 2 weeks when I finish it." Joseph received that copy from Sister Angel, and in 2 days and three nights, he read the book through. Facing opposition from his many friends and family members, he could not deny the truthfulness of the gospel, and he and his wife were baptized. They later crossed the plains, the Great Salt Lake Valley. Now the next category is the English missionary. How did they come about? In our family, I'll give you the story of at least one missionary that went to England and what he had to go through to prepare himself. This is from the Porter family. This is from my father's mother's side of the family. The Porter family originally immigrated to the United States in the 1700s. Nathan Tanner Porter was born in Vermont in 1820. His family moved several times, settling in Ohio in 1828. While there, they joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In 1832, they joined with the Saints of Jackson County, Missouri. They were among those driven by the mob violence from the possessions in the fall of 1833. Nathan passed through the trying ordeals of the times, ending with the expulsion of the Saints from Missouri, and then moved in settlement in Illinois. He was serving a mission in the eastern states when he heard the report of the Carthage jail horror of the death of the prophet. Along with other family members, Nathan left his possessions in Nauvoo and traveled west, reaching the shores of the Great Salt Lake in October of 1847. He helped his father cultivate a small piece of land, build a home. This was in the Session Settlement, which became Bountiful, and shared with his sweetheart the toils and hardships incident to the times. 4 years later, he was called to serve a mission at the Rock of Gibraltar, of all places. He once more crossed the plains with a mule and horse team, traveled to New York, then sailed to Europe. The government in Gibraltar did not allow him to stay in Gibraltar, so he returned to England, where obviously the Lord wanted him to serve, and served for 4.5 years, returning in 1856. It was not an easy trip back. Nathan crossed the Atlantic in a company of 300 saints. It was the eighth of nine boats to leave that year. They arrived in August of 1856. It's interesting to note that they reached the Platte on November 1st after the journey across. They met many experiences of suffering and death. And as you know the story, were finally rescued by men and teams from Salt Lake City, bringing much-needed supplies and aid. The handcart pioneers were now conveyed the remainder of the way in wagons, as comfortably as circumstances would permit, his journal says. Nathan was reunited with his family in Salt Lake Valley of December 15th of 1856. He lived to serve two more missions in the United States. Now for the final category, English immigrants. Going back to my father's side, Henry William Hales was born on August 7th of 1829 in Raynham, Kent County in England. In 1832, his father and family immigrated to Canada. They settled in Toronto, where they accepted the gospel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It is a great testimony. He, too, walked a great distance for his first Book of Mormon. They traveled from Toronto to Kirkland and on to the far west. They experienced all of the persecutions of the time. It was there that Henry William Hales first saw the prophet Joseph Smith when he was betrayed into the hands of the mob. He heard Joseph sentenced to be shot without having the opportunity for a hearing. They were expelled from the state with the rest of the saints and went to Quincy, Illinois, remaining there until 1841 when they moved to Nauvoo. It was there that they heard the prophet Joseph say, "I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, but I am as calm as a summer morning. I have a conscience void of offense to God and to all men, and it will yet be said, I was murdered in cold blood." This was written by his own hand in his journal. He saw Joseph and Hiram in their coffins. He knew and testified in his journal that they were men of God. Henry William Hales moved west to Salt Lake City in the spring of 1851. There he experienced Indian trouble, the Grasshopper War, shortages of commodities, especially flour, he states, differences between the U.S. government and the people of Utah, floods, and finally peace and freedom. Another example, and in conclusion, again of a child immigrant. This again coming out of the Porter family on my grandmother Hales' side. Another example was Jeanette Blaisdell, born in 1826 in Lancashire, England. Her parents were proud and happy with this new little baby girl. They wanted her that she might be the best that they could have, but times were hard, food and money were scarce, and the Blaisdells were very poor. For 9 years, the family struggled to remain together, but now there were three children, and the expenses were too high. One of the family must leave and work elsewhere to relieve the burden. It was decided that Jeanette should go. Although she was only 9 years of age, she was very mature in her ability to work and to take responsibility, it stated in her journal. It was hard to leave her family and go to a strange farm to live. Jeanette didn't feel quite so grown up or mature when saying goodbye, but she realized her responsibilities and accepted them. She worked hard, often getting up in the middle of the night to start the washing or to feed the pigs. When Jeanette was 10 years of age, the Mormon missionaries visited her family. They brought with them not only a new gospel, but also the hopes of a new and better life in America. With the family's conversion to the church, the Blaisdells, along with others, began making plans to emigrate to America. After receiving all the money he could by selling his possession, Jeanette's father found that he lacked enough money for all of them to emigrate. And you're right. Someone would have to remain behind. Again, it was decided that Jeanette would remain in England, and this time it was with real heartbreak that she waved goodbye to her loved ones. For 3 years, Jeanette lived with an uncle, working and saving to buy her passage. Her uncle owned a mill which he sold in order to have enough money for their passage. After giving Jeanette enough money for her passage, her uncle started down to the town to buy passage for the rest of the family. He was robbed of all his money. Jeanette was very despondent at the thought of leaving her relatives behind and traveling to America, but she was so homesick for her family that she decided to come anyway. On her 13th birthday, 3 years after her parents had departed, she started for America. The voyage to America was difficult and lonely for the 13-year-old girl. Water was rationed out to each passenger, and young Jeanette, being very seasick, used nearly all of her water rations in the first few weeks of the trip. Her scanty remaining portion of water couldn't be stretched out very far, and she nearly died for lack of water. After 9 long weeks, the voyage at last arrived in New Orleans instead of New York as planned. It had been blown off course during severe storms at sea. In New Orleans, she located an uncle who had come to America earlier. It was comforting for this lonely girl to see a familiar face and to be warmly received into his home. However, to learn that he had not heard from her parents or even knew that they had left England, so restless and homesick, she started alone once more. The trip up the Mississippi River to Nauvoo seemed very slow to anxious Jeanette. The boat was old and sluggish, and at times the passengers were required to walk part of the way. The days dragged on for Jeanette, whose thoughts raced ahead to the arrival in Nauvoo, the reunion with her family and the hopes and dreams of a new life with the people of her faith in this promised land. At long last, the awaited day of arrival in Nauvoo came. Jeanette was disappointed once more. Her family had not yet arrived. Disappointments and discouragements could not be kept for long, however, for the saints were a busy, dedicated, and happy people. Jeanette soon found work at the home of Joseph Young, the brother of Brigham Young. Out of her 75 cents a week earnings, she managed to save enough to buy a cow and a calf for her mother, whom she was waiting for. Months later, her parents did arrive in Nauvoo, and there was a joyous reunion. They'd been working in New York trying to save enough money for the trip to Nauvoo. The family was soon to be separated again, however, for her parents left Nauvoo with the intention of settling in Iowa and working for the Poole family. Jeanette decided to remain with Brother Young and continue to work. She journeyed with them to Winter's Quarter and was preparing to leave for Zion when she received word from her parents that they wanted Jeanette to come to Iowa. Although 300 miles from where her parents were, she started back, working her way and often walking along the side of the wagon which carried her trunks and belongings. After a month's journey, she arrived at the Poole farm in Iowa. This was a very happy time for young Jeanette. She was reunited with her family. They were all well, strong, and happy, and there was plenty of food and clothing for all. It was here that Jeanette met young John Ralston Poole. After a year lapsed, they were married. John Ralston was converted to the church, was disowned by his father. There was a trying time for the young couple. After their baby girl was born just a year later, they made preparations to leave for winter quarters and there join the saints in their trek to Utah. Joseph Young was their leader, and with a cow and a team of oxen, they started on their journey across the plains. The trip to Salt Lake was long and hard, full of suffering and sorrow. Cholera raged through the camp, taking as victim their baby girl. She was buried on the plains, and they went on. John Ralston also contracted the disease, but was healed through a blessing by Joseph Young. On the last lap of their journey, the Indians were so plentiful they couldn't even build a fire, and the nights were long, fearful, and black, she said in her journal. One of their oxen died, but they were able to finish their journey by using the cow in its place. They were unable to remain in Salt Lake long, and there it says that Jeanette and John Ralston packed their belongings and set out for Centerville in northern Utah. This country was so sparsely populated that Indians roamed it freely, and Jeanette was faced with the hardships of suffering, of pioneer life. This was just another problem to be accepted and managed as well as possible. She was responsible for providing a home for her husband and family, and this she intended to fulfill. These stories of pilgrims, converts, pioneers, child immigrants, pioneer missionaries, show the devotion, sacrifice, and dedication of our forebears. Is anything less required of us to meet today's challenge and endure to the end? In closing, I'd like to give my thanks for our English heritage and the lives that were lived worthy of English tradition, of the law of consecration, that we might learn from this and apply these moral values in our lives is my prayer. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Amen.